This is Craig Chalquist, March 6, 2015, Archetypes of Place and Planet, Jungian Ideas for Exploring the Depths Around Us.
So it is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Craig Chalquist. He is a professor of mine, and I'm still learning quite a bit from him today. So Craig, as you probably have read, he holds a PhD in depth psychology from Pacifica University, and among the many roles and activities he engages, he is the current chair of East-West Psychology at CIIS, the California Institute of Integral Studies. He is the author of several books on the intersection of psyche, nature, and place, including Terror Psychology, Re-engaging the Soul of Place, which provides a detailed description of methods for engaging the soul of place by attending to the inner and outer manifestations of a particular place. And among other books, he's written a book on discovering and working with personal myth called Storied Lives, Discovering and Deepening Your Personal Myth. He is executive editor of the Journal of Holistic Psychology and founder of Immanence, the Journal of Applied Mythology, Legend, and Folklore. And he will soon be offering an online course in applied mythology through the Depth Psychology Insights website. And if you haven't visited that website, it's quite an amazing website, and lots of material there. So the last chapter of Storied Lives is titled Finding Your Place. After spending most of the book discussing the importance of knowing and engaging our personal myth creatively and consciously, in part so that the myth does not live through us unconsciously and thereby wreak havoc in our lives, Craig turns to how one's personal myth intersects with the myth of being played out and embodied by the place in which we find ourselves. In this chapter, he discusses how one can come to know the myth of place and how that myth both informs and may also be informed by our own myths. He suggests that as regional mythologies dissipate as a result of industrialization, an almost exclusive focus on rationalism and other forces, we may need to refocus our mythic attention on the transhuman, transcultural, planetary, and cosmological. And he ends the book with this short paragraph. For all we know, Earth's own myth spins outward into webs of meaning stretching across a sentient, myth-filled cosmos. Be that as it may, personal myth work ecologized invites us to hold our evolving myths as unfolding plots in the blue-green mind of this floating, dazzling ball of life that deserves our better attention, unquote. It is this imaginative, intelligent, living, expansive, connecting, soulful, and poetic way of knowing and being that Craig invites us all to participate, to partake. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Craig Chalquist.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks especially to the Young Society for bringing me here from the Bay Area, and to Kelly, and particularly Kevin, who made this all possible. Thank you. I was trying to, a moment ago, figure out what was up on the screen, because it wasn't my presentation. And I'm still, let's see, what is this anyway? Oh, I see. So I've been reading Ursula K. Le Guin a lot lately. Been reading her since I was a boy, actually, but only recently really getting into her essays on fantasy and myth. So in a way, I guess this was a Freudian slide or something, but whatever it was you were looking at before was her work, which is interesting stuff, but we won't deal with too much of it tonight. So I'll go back to my slideshow here, and then, yeah, go ahead and turn that on. While this is coming up, a little background on where this all comes from. When I was studying depth psychology at Pacifica, as particularly young, I kept seeing what I was learning in the classroom and seeing in my dreams happening out in the world, and not just the human cultural world, although it was going on out there too. So as an example of that, I got some training in permaculture, which is a way of designing food systems the way nature does, intelligently, complexly, sustainably. And my permaculture teacher at one point had us do an exercise, and she said, I want you to go outside and look for primary patterns by which nature organizes itself. And she meant things like, you know, branching patterns and spiral patterns and circles and things like that, wave patterns, you know. And of course, Jung immediately came to mind. And I thought, well, these are archetypes. The same spiral that I see going down my drain when the water flows through it, or the plant that comes up this way, looks to me like the spiral of what Jung would think of as individuation. But at that time, nobody was really talking or writing about that much, just a few people. Michael Conforti was one of them. And I thought, well, I'm really interested now that I'm practicing being an extrovert. I really want to know what's happening out in the world, in addition to what's going on in my inner life, you know. So that's the point of departure for all this. Since then, I've been going through countrysides and cities, looking for some of these primary patterns, these archetypal patterns. And along the way, I noticed that there were often myths that would attach themselves to those patterns. So when I teach, I often have my students go through the neighborhood in San Francisco. If you've been there, you know what the SoMa is, the South of Market neighborhood. And we look for archetypes and myths out in the streets. The last time I did this, our neighborhood was about to be almost completely rebuilt. There's huge amounts of money flowing into SoMa, appropriate name in some ways, and it's intoxicating everybody who lives there in terms of now we're going to get rich because all the telecoms are moving in, and we've got Twitter right down the street, and Sanyo and Yahoo and other people. So right before all that happened, we were doing one of our little tours, and we went out to this cafe across the street from where I work, and me and my class, so there's me and like 15 other people, and we were looking at a sculpture of a butterfly, and that's up on the wall. And I was telling them a little bit about how, you know, in some mythologies, the butterfly is a symbol of, like for the Greeks, symbol of the psyche, symbol of transformation, things like that. And as we were going through this, a real butterfly showed up. And yeah, I've never, the whole time I've worked there, seen a real butterfly in this highly urbanized neighborhood. And it floated in, and it landed on the shoulder of one of my students, which blew all of us away. It was such a beautiful synchronicity. So I told the students at the time, I think there's going to be a lot of transformation happening here. And there has been. Not all of it particularly pleasant to look at, but in my office now at work, I look out my window, and I used to have a kind of a nice view of 10th and Market, and now I have a view of the side of a building 30 feet away. So I'm going to see if some of our students can go paint murals on it. That would at least be nicer to look at than what I see right now. But anyway, so I've just given you a small example of what I want to go into with this slideshow, which is how can we move through urban spaces or countrysides, or I'm going to concentrate mostly on cities at first, and be aware of these archetypal patterns and myths, and how can that help us feel a conscious relationship to these places instead of just looking at ourselves as objects lost within them or just travelers moving through them, but how can we actually have a relationship? So that's what I'm going to do. This ought to look familiar. By the way, this is my first time here in Seattle, so this is all new to me in a way. So I'll have to see if, and I've made some, we're going to focus on Seattle a little bit as we go, and if I crash and burn, that's why. So you can all tell me where I'm wrong about my surmises about this place. So a little bit about where we're going to head through the presentation. I want to start first by talking about this piece of archetypes in nature and what that could mean. I'll talk briefly about that. And then I'm going to give examples of archetypes in cities, which will bring us to Seattle. When I was looking over images and pictures, I read a little bit of the history of Seattle. I talked to people who lived here or live here, and it seemed to me that there were some patterns unfolding here, and that's what I want to present and see if I'm anywhere near the mark with that. But by doing this, whether I am or not, it'll give you a little bit of a feel for one way of using Jungian tools to explore what's happening between you and a place. And that's the main idea here. I'm going to give you some tips for how to do this on your own. And by the way, I have a PDF copy of all of these slides. So what I'll do is I'll let you know. You have my email address, so anybody who wants it can just email me or what have you, and then I'll send you a link to the slides, and you can download them. So I'll give you some tips. They'll be on the slides too. And then I want to, at the very end, go a little further in terms of what does this imply about our relationship to bigger places, not just a city, but a region, the continent where we find ourselves right now, and even the Earth and the cosmos itself. So we'll get really big at the very end. And that is where we're going to head. So I should mention, too, that because I'm not an analyst, I'm not under the obligation of, what's a good way of saying this? So colleagues and friends of mine who are Jungian analysts have to train people in the right way to do things, and they have to emphasize proper technique. When you deal with deep psychological material, there's safety issues involved, and so you really have to be concerned with getting it right. I don't. So thank the gods. Yeah. So what I'm going to do is and I found this useful for my students too. I play with Jung's ideas a little bit, and I stretch them because I've learned over the years that they snap back really well. They're sturdy ideas. We can get a lot of work out of them as well as a lot of play. So I'm going to take some of Jung's ideas and just see what we can do with them in a spirit of play. So just so you know. And I like this in defense of what I'm about to do, right? I'm mining Jung for quotes that back it up. without this playing with fantasy, no creative work has ever yet come to birth. The debt we owe to the play of the imagination is incalculable. Can't think of anyone who said that better. So briefly, that word archetype, whole books have been written about this. When I turned to Jung for the short version and I look through collected works and the seminars and the letters, sometimes I come across this one. I've been rereading Jung over the last year or so, everything that's been translated into English, because I'm teaching a class right now that uses a lot of his work. So mentally expressed instincts, I think that's the shortest definition I've been able to find so far. And I wanted to mention too that in the collected works, Jung mentions that the word archetype has a long cultural history, and he mentions St. Augustine and some other people. I've recently become aware by rereading the Gnostic texts, the class I'm teaching puts the two together, Jung and Gnosticism, that archetype is actually a Gnostic term. And there are a number of terms that Jung borrows from the Gnostics, some of which we know about, but there's others that are... they're not stated in the same with the same words in the Gnostic vocabulary, but they're very similar ideas. So sooner or later, when in my abundant spare time, I'm going to write more about that. But I like it that Jung and Gnosticism are close that way. It feels good to think of it that way. So anyway, back to archetype. A quote from Jung: "Every instinct bears within it the pattern of its situation." And then he gives an example: the daily course of the sun and the regular alternation of day and night must have imprinted themselves on the psyche in the form of an image from primordial times. I'm not sure he's stuck with that way of thinking about an archetype, but I personally like it because it connects self and world, kind of like this. So my point of departure for the playing that I'm about to do is actually this earlier way of Jung's earlier way of holding an archetype together with a pattern that occurs in the natural world. How it got there, I won't go into. But I don't think my impression is that we're not really that separate from the world as we sometimes suppose. I like this quotation: "Dragons make their lairs by watercourses. preferably near a ford or some such dangerous crossing. Jinn and other devils are to be found in waterless deserts or dangerous gorges. Spirits of the dead haunt the eerie thickets of the bamboo forest. Treacherous nixies and sea serpents live in the depths of the ocean and its whirlpools. Those of you who've read the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien know that he didn't really like psychological explanations of fantasy, but I think, and one of my students is Becca Tarnas, who's the daughter of Rick Tarnas, if you've heard of him, Cosmos and Psyche. I agree with Becca, who's a Tolkien expert, that if he had read more young, he would have liked him. And I think if he had read this, he would have liked it. I like to fantasize that he would have anyway. So here again, holding images of fantasy and myth together with actual places and landscapes and natural settings. This is a couple of times he talks about animals having archetypes. We can identify them, archetypes, even in animals, and the animals themselves understand one another in this respect. So when I look at some images of animals and I think about things like trans-species communication, which is just exploding as a field over the last 10 years, I can understand what he means better, I think. All of these, I wish we could see these images a little better. They all look so alive, and in the case of one of them, or a couple of them, actually, they look like they're in prayer or contemplation somehow. So here we see some mandalas outside us, in nature, in human cultural work, in our own bodies, these primary patterns that I was talking about earlier. When I looked at the brain from this perspective, this archetypal perspective, it made me wonder if the brain structure is a kind of archetypal tree. So another question, do only humans individuate? Well, perhaps, but look at all these spirals. Whatever they mean, ultimately, they're out there. That's one of the most, to me anyway, the most intriguing and worthy of appreciation aspects of the natural world, is that it creates such amazing diversity from so relatively few simple patterns. Simply by elaborating them or repeating them over and over. I've come to think of diversity not as like a nice add-on, but to use a philosophical term, ontological, built into existence, built into reality. So I'm going to narrow my focus a little bit here to cities and go into that with you a little. Another thing, when I was first looking into this, that interested me was how often all over the world cities are built near not only rivers but sacred sites. They grow up around them. As though right from the very beginning, in the middle of the city, there's some sort of a myth or a ritual or something that people feel is numinous, and then the city gets built all around that. And sometimes the people who later show up in the city don't even remember what that is anymore, but perhaps it's still there in some form or another. Another way of thinking about this is that a city is a kind of archetypal alchemical vessel. So just for fun, I've taken some alchemical instrumentation and I've stuck it next to a few cityscapes just to try to appreciate that myself, actually. James Hillman has an entire volume of his, what are they called, the Uniform Works? Something like that. I can't imagine why they're called that for him. but the volume's called Psyche in the City, I think. It's amazing. I knew Hillman, and I wish I had read that volume and could have talked to him about it while he was still around. So here's a quote from him. "That flowing imagination which founded the city in the first place can be refound. It is planted in our midst always, ready to flower, if we begin not with the problem of what needs to be changed, or moved, or built, or demolished, but begin with what is already here and still stands and sings of its soul." So I'm going to mention a few of the ideas and tools from Jung that I'm about to make use of here. So wholeness. What if we thought of a city, or for that matter a region or even a continent, as a psyche, as a self-regulating system, a self-balancing system of many forces? When I teach depth psychology, I sometimes give the beginning students kind of a brief outline or laundry list, for that matter, of some of the basic ideas that depth psychology always comes back to. And one of them is this idea that the psyche is an arena of many interacting forces that regulate themselves, if they're allowed to. So what if we thought of a city that way? Greater than the sum of its parts. And in that sense, it includes us. So in a way, it's even more complex than we are, because we're a part of it. Secondly, what if we took the metaphoric awareness that Jung taught us to use with, for instance, dreams and symptoms, and carried that through where we walk or where we drive? So if we, you know, all of us, I think, in here probably have done some level of dream work. So we use perhaps active imagination. We summon up the dream symbol and have a conversation with it, or allow it to act on us somehow, and maybe even step into the picture with it. Or we free associate to a symbol. Those sorts. We know how to do that with many kinds of symbols, actually, dream symbols, art, things like that. So what if we did it with the city? We'll find out. In alchemy, there's a procedure called iteratio, and it means to repeat something over and over in order to process it and process it more and more thoroughly. So if we go out in the city, what are the images and the motifs that recur, that come up over and over again? I think that these can perhaps give us a sense of the city's character, just as with people. They're all those basic themes that we tend to come back to throughout our entire lives. And if you, by the way, if you come to the workshop tomorrow, we're going to spend some time on that. As an example of it, if you go all the way back through my ancestry, as far as I've been able to go, I should mention I'm adopted. So most adoptees are not curious about where they came from. I always was. Plus, it's just convenient defense mechanism when you're having trouble with your parents, because then you can say, oh, I don't really come from these people, you know. And but then if you go as far as I did and you meet those people, and you go, oh, I came from them. Well, wow. So much for that defense. if you look back through your ancestry, looking for iteratio, looking for repeating motifs, you'll find some very interesting ones that will actually explain a great deal about who you are, even if you were completely ignorant of what that ancestry was. And the same with things like episodes that repeat in childhood, basic themes that come up over and over again. To use a specific example, I think one of the things that kind of, that's a good way of saying this, set me up to be interested in Jung's work. We all know that he emphasizes the opposites a lot, right? In the Red Book, he talks about, when he doesn't know how all this works, and he's learning it from the deep psyche, he talks about trying to smash them together and make unity out of it. And his imaginal figures all, no, no, you don't do it that way, you know. So he eventually learns, no, you hold the opposites. And then that their relationship reveals itself if you're patient, you know. So this is a lesson, of course, I'm still trying to learn. And the opposites are in my all over my ancestry. You know, all this two different fighting groups of people coming together. I was born with the sun and the moon in opposition. And it's hard to get more basic than that in the natal chart, you know. It just comes up over and over again. So what I want to do is look at not only images that recur in dreams or in ancestry or things like that, but how do they recur in the city? What can they tell us about the place? So we'll do a little bit of that coming up. Jung had that concept of the transcendent function, which I've kind of already described in a way, that there's something that bridges conscious and unconscious to make a third. He uses the alchemical term sometimes, the third thing or the alloy or the coagulatio. When you have two things, the organism or the life or the bridge that comes out of them is new. It's novel. It's a higher order psychic reality. So how does that operate in a city? Is it possible that when you take the terrain and the people, there's actually a kind of consciousness that comes up from that? Those of you who do systems thinking might be swimming in a similar circle with this too. It's a similar idea. And then whenever I explore places, especially cities, I always ask myself, so mythologically, who is here? And I really, now that I've been to New York City, I really appreciate even more Joseph Campbell's analogy in The Hero with a Thousand Faces, where he says that myths recur all the time. We can't get away from them. They're everywhere. They're down on the corner waiting for the traffic light to change. My one regret, though, is, which is redeemable, actually, the last time I was in New York City, I forgot to go to the intersection that he actually mentions. I wonder if what's there, has anybody actually been to that intersection? In that famous quote where he says, down on 42nd and something or other, there's Beauty and the Beast or whoever waiting for the traffic light to change. I want to go there and see what's there and take some pictures. So if you ever go there and take some pictures, send me some. I'd like to, yeah. That's a good idea. I should do that. Yeah, I should do that. Good. And then maybe we can get a civic movement, like a little plaque for Campbell or something, you know. That'd be neat. So what if we thought of a city as an altar? By the way, I should mention along these lines a really great book. The author's name is Peter Ackroyd, and it's called London, the Biography. And I don't think he even studied Jung, but he's intuitively, maybe he reincarnated, I don't know. He's intuitively Jungian about how he holds a lot of this. And he talks about London as a place of many altars with many gods, many archetypes going on, to say it in Jungian. And he uses an example of this old fragment that was found in the London Underground when it was under construction. And it goes back to the Saxon days. And it's this old piece of pottery or a fragment of a wall or something. And when you look at the lettering, it's not in English, but it looks like the words, "We are here." It's kind of eerie. So anyway, I really like that. It's a great book. The city comes right to life when you read it. It's amazing. So one other tool, or a couple others, actually. Sometimes when I'm visiting a city, I'm going to try this tonight and see what happens, where I've never been. When I'm going to sleep at night, I wait till I'm kind of in that space of reverie and sleepiness, and then I'll do a mini act of imagination where I summon up the image of the city for a minute, and then I treat it as a personification. You know, we all know from Jung's work that psychic material tends to show up as people, especially in dreams. So I treat the image of a city like a dream, like a person, and I say, what should I know about you? And as we go, I'll mention a few examples of when I've done that in the past, and if I somehow forget to, remind me, and I'll mention some. But you can have amazing things happen when you do that. So I recommend it as a practice. And then in terms of amplification, just finding out the basic history of you know, where am I and who are the native people and do they still live here and what are their stories and what's the geology of this place like? We're going to look at actually all of those when we get to Seattle here in a minute. It gives you a real sense of the character of a place too. So overall, here's the question, what if we interpret a cityscape the way we would interpret a dream? And that if there's one thing to perhaps take away from how to do all this, maybe that one, that's the one. How can I walk through a city and interpret the way I would a dream? So before we actually do it, a brief little theoretical piece. There's actually relatively new forms of psychology, environmental psychology, and things like that, that look at all of this on a surface level, and they're interested in things like, how does having the sun out make people walk faster as opposed to a cloudy day, stuff like that. So there's, in that kind of research, and it goes deeper than that, it's things like when a hurricane hits a city, what does it do to the mental health of the people who live there? Really important questions, not just trivial ones. But that sort of research assumes that we're separate from the place. It has the subject-object split already built into it. So the scientific question becomes, how do I figure out how this affects that? The approach that I prefer when I do what I think of as deep work with place is to assume that we are already part of it, to assume that that separation is a cultural artifact that we don't need to maintain. So the questions then become different. For instance, what features of the land are also features of ourselves? Where are the valleys in me? What's happening with the neighborhood inside my psyche and vice versa? So holding them together. What complexes and stories do we share with the land? And in the workshop, we're going to look at that. It's often very interesting, especially with, I've done this mostly with students, where we do some inquiry into, so what's up for you right now in terms of what your challenges are psychologically, and can you find a parallel around you? And the parallels are often quite interesting. Sometimes a city is suffering, or a place, a village, what have you, a town, is suffering from something that's very similar to what somebody's undergoing internally. It's uncanny how often it happens. Or I should say, it's uncanny as long as we assume that they're separate. I tend not to anymore. But it's just fascinating to think about why we wind up in certain places. So more about that as we go as well. And this last one I mentioned already, what if we interpret a place like a dream? So I'll give you some examples. This was Aviva Joseph's work. She is a graduate of Pacifica. She's now one of my colleagues, PhD. And in part, her doctoral work focused on how the structure of Jerusalem is reflected in the conflicts that play out there generation after generation. And it turns out actually, well, a couple of things. That for one, in her opinion, the city's actually shaped like a divided heart, which astounded her when she learned it because she grew up in Jerusalem. And also, there's a lot of earthquake faults running underneath Jerusalem itself. And in many cases, they run parallel to the fences that divide communities. So if you think about that, it sounds like, I think this is true, I've seen it in a lot of different places. It's almost as though what we don't recognize around us in some cases acts like an unconscious dynamic. So just as if you're unaware of that you're angry or you're unaware that you're sad about something or what have you, that it tends to be up for you eventually, and you might even act it out unconsciously until you realize, oh, I'm angry or I'm sad about that. Similarly, features of the landscape tend to repeat themselves in human behavior until we actually go, oh, we have a relation to this. This is me that I'm looking at here. So That's one example. This one I'm very fond of since I work there. San Francisco's way too extroverted for me ever to live there. I just can't handle it. But so I live in the East Bay, and I live in El Cerrito, which is a much quieter place, especially up on the hill. And I take the BART train into the city almost every day. And almost every day I have to adjust because it's just so intense. That, by the way, I don't have that in the slideshow, but an interesting question to ask. We were talking about this earlier today. Sometimes when I ask people, is the place you live, whether it's a city or a town or what have you, would you say it's introverted or extroverted? People usually can answer that question. I expected that people would go, oh, that's meaningless. Those are human, you know. But you can often have some sense of, even if it's not a human entity that we're talking about, some sense of that. And when I go in, when I get off the train from the city and I walk into El Cerrito, I immediately feel the difference. El Cerrito is so, what's a good, you know, so inward and introspective and quiet where I live. And not everybody in the city is like that, obviously, but I think it's a characteristic of the place itself somehow. But San Francisco, the myth that I think fits this place fairly well is Dionysus. So we're the god of ecstasy, drama, the transsexual god, the wild god. The god who comes into the city and goes out in the country, who collects maenads, the female priestesses who are the ecstatic followers of him. A lot of the students in the school that I work at are interested in what they call entheogens, substances, medicines for altering consciousness. I didn't understand that when I first started working there because I'm not by any means a pioneer in that field, but I thought, why is everybody like doing ayahuasca and, you know, going to Peru and talking to the shamans and everything? And then the more I saw this Dionysian imagery in the city, I thought, oh, okay, now this is making more sense. I kind of get this, you know. And in my own neighborhood in the city, Soma, you know, it wasn't consciously named after the intoxicating drink of the Hindu gods, but it fits anyway. So... and then, of course, there's the shadow side of that, you know, intoxication in the negative sense, drunkenness, drug addiction, which is all of which is happening in the city. But sometimes when, for instance, in that middle picture, when I look at images of the city from space, the bridges remind me of these grapevines coming off of Dionysus. I kind of like that. So, you know, when I started to do this kind of work, I asked myself the obvious question, which is, well, what if this is just a projection? And after all, this is European myth, but the people who lived here originally weren't Europeans. So I thought, okay, so if I talk to the people, the indigenous people who are still here, then if I'm actually sensing something happening, they should know. Because they've been here a lot longer than anybody else has. So I began doing that. And at this point, it took me a long time, as you might imagine, but I wrote a trilogy that is basically a psychocartography of all of California. It took me 11 years. And so wherever I could, I would get a sense of which myth is in which place, and then I would try to contact the native community and talk to them about it. And in many cases, including San Francisco, people would say, you know, we had a god like that. Totally different name, different imagery. So that gave me the sense that, you know, there actually is something here. That I'm seeing it through a European lens, but I'm seeing something archetypal. Because the people who were here before, who are the real experts on this place, and the real authorities, they say something like that is here too. So we both have come to similar conclusions from very different frameworks. And incidentally, as one other example, so I spent some time around the Klamath River in California, and I was amazed at the amount of snake imagery that comes up around there in the art, in stories, in the history of the place. And so one of my former students is an indigenous Californian who grew up there. So I asked him about it, And I said, I don't want to pry into your stories that are private, so if I'm intruding, please tell me and I'll not do that. But I'm seeing a lot of serpents coming up in this part of California. Your people have been here for who knows how long. Does that resonate with you? And he said, yes. There is actually a serpent in our stories that swims through the Klamath River. It bridges the land and the ocean, and it has to do with the initiation of our boys. And the serpent has a name, and he told me what it was, and he gave me a little bit of the story, and I went, wow. So when this happens, if you're, what's a good way of saying this? If you're right about the primary myth that's playing out in a place, it should line up on many different levels. It should be reflected in the land itself, which seems to be the case. So here's San Francisco, the altar of Dionysus. The other thing, too, that's kind of a self-check on this kind of work, and I've actually been wrong about places and had dreams and nightmares that tell me you're completely out of it when it comes to this place. Start over, you know. It happened to me in Orange County. no surprise there. But so if another check on this is if you're right about what's happening in a neighborhood or a place or a village, you should put it to the test. So this used to be what the neighborhood near CIIS looked like. And one of the, so I was looking for iteratio, I was looking for patterns. And a pattern that I saw was the symbol M all over the neighborhood. So it's hard to see, but on that last slide, that whole building has M's on the side of it. It's right down the block from us. That used to be the building next door before they tore it down, and it's really hard to see in the slide, but you might see a little blob of light right here. That's the letter M. It was torn off a sign by the wind, and it landed on the roof, and I looked out the window and went, God, there's an M there, and I took a picture of it. And then there's some other ones here in this slide, too. Why this matters is because I was also noticing a lot of water imagery happening, and you can see a bit of that. This cafe has kind of a, you can hardly see it in this picture, but it's got this wavy pattern. And there are buildings in this neighborhood that have kind of like this, you know, there's always water leaks and hydrants going off and stuff like that. There was one guy who was watering the sidewalk with a hose for months. I don't know why he was doing it. And M is a Phoenician symbol for water. So I thought, okay, so here's the test. So I was taking my students around, and I said, you know, it sure would be interesting to know if there was underground water in this neighborhood, because that would kind of substantiate this. Otherwise, it's just my fantasy. And one of the students said, oh, well, I've lived here for 5 years, and whenever they do construction projects, they flood. There's a stream underground here. So if you're right about what's happening, the repeating image and whatever's in the land itself, and however the image shows up in these other spheres of experience, should line up. And in that, I would compare it to when you have a big insight about something that fits together huge pieces of your life. There's a great quote that I can never get right from Thomas Merton, and I've had the experience of this, where he says something like, once you get a sense of who you really are and what your life is about, your life undergoes a huge simplification. And that's, I like to think of that quote in terms of this sort of work. You suddenly go, I get this place, or this neighborhood, or whatever. Or internally, you know, now I know why I've always done this. And it shows in my work, in my relationships, in my choice of whatever, and, you know, it all comes together. So the same with this sort of work. In the case of, by the way, in the case of Orange County, I had a little theory about what was happening there mythologically, and I went to bed one night, and I dreamed that I'd had a relationship in Orange County and that had ended a while back. And so my partner was in my dream, and she comes up to me. And you know how dreams, and Jung pointed this out, when it's not really that person in the dream, so the dream changes them a little bit as a hint, like, no, it's not really her. So it looked like her, but it wasn't her. And she had kind of a stern look on her face. And I think for the purpose of the dream, the main thing for me was that she was associated to Orange County. So she comes up to me in the dream, and she has this like thick stack of paper, and she hands it to me like this. And I look at it, and it's a printout of my work on Orange County. And it's all marked in red. All of it. Every word, every sentence, you know. And I woke up and went, okay, I don't get this place. I need to start over. I think I eventually did get it, especially when I came across there was a news story about how once again, when they were doing construction to build yet another suburb, they came across, let's see, who are the native people there? They call them Gabrielenos, but they call themselves something else, obviously. But there's a lot of artifacts that are found, but they're of a specific shape. They look like a cogwheel. So when you reflect that Orange County has enormous amounts of oil underneath and that it used to be hugely volcanic, then you might start thinking of Hephaestus, the gigantic god who was the architect of Olympus, and all those metal things that he used to make. And he made big things too, which is an Orange County specialty, the Crystal Cathedral, Disneyland. There's an old story that Hephaestus, to amuse himself and keep himself company because he lived alone, he built what we would now call robots. He built automatons, golden automatons, and infused them with animation so that they would be his servants. And I remember thinking, oh, well, that's animatronics, right? So anyway, I think Hephaestus is a big presence in Orange County, perhaps. This place I know a bit better because I was born here. And I lived here for most of my childhood in San Diego County. So I was thinking about how much of a crossroads the place has always been. And of course, Hecate is the goddess of crossroads. And she's a bit scary sometimes when she's initiating people. She holds up two torches, and she has to do with borders and boundaries. And the strange thing about San Diego is that two strange things. One is that geographically, I should say geologically, the downtown itself has these huge splits in it. They're actually cliffs in the heart of San Diego itself. Big splits. So if you think about splitting, that's what San Diego does. Secondly, the place was named after Saint Diego, and he was at one time a soldier monk who defended a Spanish border in a war. So, in other words, San Diego was named after the monk of borders before there was an international border there. So I was thinking about all this and kind of playing with these mythic images, and then a friend of mine who still lives in San Diego calls me up and says, did you hear about this big explosion that we had? This was a couple of years ago. And he said, you know how every 4th of July we go out to the bay and we light off all the fireworks, but it's a show. It's supposed to not happen all at once. And there was a mistake, you know, or a glitch or something, and there was this massive explosion and they all went up at once. So I went looking for this on the internet, and I found these images. And when I saw that picture, I immediately thought of the two torches that Hecate always carries. And incidentally, Hecate is the goddess of witches, and there's a very powerful Wiccan community in San Diego. So again, what are the patterns? That's a picture of her right there. What are the patterns? Let's switch a little bit here. So this was taken near where the first atomic bomb was tested. Matt Cochran took this photograph. He's a geologist and a depth psychology student, which I think is a fabulous combination. And he went out there and actually camped out. I think it was illegal because it's a military reservation. So he was doing his ninja thing out there. And he asked the place for dreams. He wanted to see what was going on an unconscious level when he tried to relate to the place that way. And as he was out there, he came across this stone. And he asked some people who have lived out there for a very long time about what these petroglyphs were. And the people he interviewed told him, well, these are actually, especially that bird shape, this is Thunderbird. And he said, Thunderbird, does Thunderbird show up here? And they said, oh, this is Thunderbird's place. This is where Thunderbird happens, you know. And he looked at these other markings and he thought, again, maybe projection, I don't know. He thought they looked like explosions and bombs. So he asked himself the question, well, how could this be? And his thought about it is that Thunderbird represents something essential about the character of the land itself. So when the U.S. military arrived, they were sort of acting out the story of Thunderbird unconsciously. So first, the atomic bomb, and now they still use it actually as a gunnery range. So in a way, they are, well, a poetic way of saying it might be that they are dancing in the drama of this local myth without really realizing it. Perhaps. I did say we would play. So a couple of more of these, and then I'm going to come to Seattle. If you've seen UFO movies, I recognize this. Who was it? Richard Dreyfuss was scooping one of these and is, this means something. Remember that? That's a great scene. So, again, myth and place, right? So there's six tribes that live around this. And they all have similar stories about how there were girls who were chased by either a bear or some bears. And the girls ran up the Devil's Tower, and the bears ran after them and made these marks on the tower with their claws. And the girls escaped, and they became the Pleiades. And so the marks are there to help tell the story. Many indigenous cultures, perhaps all of them, when they tell stories like that, the stories are, they happen in a particular place. So they're not separate from where they occur. So fast forward to now, where the tribes that live around this are fighting against mountain climbers who go there once a year, or more often than that, actually. And I don't know what it's called because I don't climb mountains, but they're wearing, when they go up this the Devil's Tower, the mountaineers wear equipment that's like steel claws, and they climb like this. This is sacred to the people who live here, so they're trying to get laws passed to prohibit this. They've been unable to do that. But from the point of view of what we're looking at here, again, the climbers are acting out this part of the story unconsciously. And the six tribes maybe are the six girls who are trying to preserve, you know, to keep themselves safe against this attack. So this one's really reaching. I won't go too much into this one, but it just struck me, you know, somebody asked me at one point, well, have you looked at capital cities like Paris and Moscow and, you know, stuff like that? And so I started doing that. And the rivers, the pattern of rivers in Washington, D.C., just struck me as kind of womb-like. And then I started learning things about the place, like how they call it the Beltway Bubble. You know, that it's a freeway that goes around the whole city, but it's more than that. It's a cultural bubble, an insulator. And how the buildings in Washington, D.C. cannot grow beyond a certain height. They have to be, in a sense, they have to stay kind of small. If I remember correctly, the highest number of people who cannot drive in a city is in Washington, D.C., and also the highest illiteracy rate in the country. So in our country's capital, people can't read. The people who are usually considered founders of the country are also called fathers. The place is right next to Virginia. So, you know, you can play with this, right? And it's hard to say where like free association stops and what's really going on starts. It's a little fuzzy. But anyway, it's kind of fun to think of it this way, especially when you look at some of the politics of any party. It's not restricted to any party, you know, that come out of Washington, D.C. and how regressive they are. Michael Mead and a number of other people have talked about how it might be more useful to see that kind of political dysfunction not as a mental disorder, but as developmental arrest, as just plain emotional immaturity asserting itself. And so we are getting to Seattle here. I just wanted to show this. I was looking at the Statue of Liberty. I think it was Irving Berlin who said it was Miss Liberty. But anyway, I thought one day, you know, she reminds me of somebody. And then I came across Fortuna, who's over there. So I've been playing with this with people who live in New York City and are very familiar with it. Is it true that Fortuna is the goddess there, that Fortune goes woo, and, you know, that's why people go there to make their way in the world and to get known, and that's why all the big publishing houses are there, and Times Square is there, and the stock market, absolutely, and Wall Street and all the rest of it. So that's something to think about, too. And I think Washington was actually sworn in a bank in New York City, wasn't he? Yeah, that kind of makes sense. So you can expect rises and falls in a place like that.
And the line from the song, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah, yep. Oh, I'm glad you mentioned songs, because there's something I forgot to say when I was mentioning San Francisco. Now we're at Seattle. So there's a story in which Dionysus is dismembered and eaten by titans, gigantic inflated beings. And all that's left is his heart. And so Zeus saves the heart of his son, and Dionysus is reborn. So now, whenever I hear that song, I Left My Heart in San Francisco, I'm like, Dionysus did too, maybe. So now we come to Seattle. So let's see what we can find out here. When I was looking around, I like to look at maps also as kind of dream symbols and images just to see what happens. And I thought, and this could just be me, but I mean, crowns of near my mountains, kind of a crown-shaped image on the map. I started seeing crowns everywhere. And then I began looking into names. Names were always really interesting. So nickname of Seattle, Queen City. It's on seven hills, like Rome, one of which is actually named Capitol. It's located in the Pacific Ring of Fire, which is a crown shape. Seat of King County, of course. And then all these royal place names around here. I was blown away. Queen Anne Hill, Olympic Hills, Georgetown, Broadview, Newcastle. And then the names of early settlers here, many king names. Hiram, David, Saul, Ballard. It refers to a bald head anyway. And then there's some other ones coming up here too. So it makes me wonder, is there a motif of either kingship or queenship happening here? Chief Seattle, he's usually called. Look at these names: Arthur, David, Henry, George, John, Charles, all the names of kings. And here's some more. There's a nice crown there, actually. So when I've I seem to have stumbled onto whatever are the most recurrent theme or images. I go looking for other aspects of it. So heights and peaks around here, an obvious one is the mountains. But these names too, Beacon Hill, Kingdom, which sounds like kingdom in a way. You know, kingship is and queenship is elevation. Hal is the name of a king. Where you find kings and queens, you find authority and also the resistance to it. So competition between the original people who lived here, some tribes competing with each other. The Mardi Gras riots, with an earthquake the next day. That's interesting timing. I'm still trying to get over the tornado that landed on World Environment Day in Montana. That's amazing. 2003, I think that was. So, and it's in the ground too. Plates grinding against each other. And this is no news to you. World Trade Organization protests. Origin of grunge. It's the job of a king, ideally anyway, to be able to be far-seeing and visionary. If you read Chinese stories about the Yellow Emperor, he was such a king. And I see some of that here, these expositions. This is the first time I knew that there was actually a science fiction museum and Hall of Fame here. That's great. We don't have one of those where I am. Even the name Alki, by and by. Don't tell any Californians I said this, but we like to think that we're progressive. And we're where it's all happening, and you know, where California goes, so goes the nation. It's not true. Actually, it's true sometimes, but we're more, I think we have a lot more of the divine child energy that Jung talked about. He used the term puer. That's California, right? We're good at dreaming up the possibilities. We seldom implement them, but they're nice dreams. And of course, crowns all over the place, right? In Gnostic myth, a crown meant possession of gnosis. True spiritual knowing. There's a lot of crowns falling in Jung's red book, one in particular toward the end of the red book. And it has a little inscription on it that says, "Love never ends." A crown can be a symbol of consciousness, attainment, sublimation, an alchemical procedure that spiritualizes the material, rulership. So here's some psychological takes on this image, power. And the question, well, whose crown is it? Is it Saturn's in terms of a myth, a ruling myth? Structure, the harvest, the golden age, terrible shadow. There's a presentation I do sometimes where I show students seated in rows, and I put there's a little caption that says taking the SAT test, and I underline SAT, and I go, yeah, that's the God who ate his children. Yeah. Is it Hera's crown? Rhea's? There's a picture of her right there. I don't know. I don't know the answer to this. This is work for you to do. Why should I have all the fun? So what? I don't know what myth is here. I think I know what archetypes are happening here. But I don't know what the myth is. That would be, I'd like to know, actually. And the question, did the indigenous tribes here know of some ruling or powerful or authoritative deity? That would be an interesting thing to ask them. And so a speculation. Maybe what's happening is the king and the queen are here. And that is an alchemical image. Anybody who's studied alchemy, especially the kind that Jung wrote about, knows that to create the philosopher's stone, the magical, all-healing, all-powerful device at the end of the opus, the king and the queen, the principles that they symbolize, must marry. And conjunctio is the Latin term for that, the conjunction, the marriage, the sacred wedding. Maybe that's what's happening here. That is from the Rosarium woodcuts that Jung wrote so much about. So some conjunctio images. This Seattle is itself on a land bridge. It's a port. Key center for shipping containers, containment. So that image is a shameless pitch for my book. So some tips, and then we're coming to the end here, and I'll mention these briefly, and then I'm going to widen the lens a little bit and finish with that. So if you're interested in doing something like this, and you can do this with your house, you can do it with your neighborhood. I sometimes ask people as an exercise, if you have a backyard, go in your backyard and pretend it's your unconscious. And see what's out there. What's in the attic? If you have a basement, not many people do out here, but what's the most lived-in part of your house, and what's the least lived-in part of your house, and why? And you can actually make this work for you in many ways. Because I work so much, I don't play enough, and I also weighed a lot more this time last year than I do right now. So I thought, all right, when I move into my new place, I need a room that's for play and exercise. So I have like a gym room, but it's got musical instruments in it. And that room is also the best lit room of the house, too. And I did that quite on purpose. I can't miss that place. When I walk by it, there's light pouring through it. So that's, to me, that's a message of go in there and remember to play. So what's the least used part of the house? Where do I tend not to go, and what does that bring up for me? So look for symbols and motifs in the land, in the ecology, in the geology, in any aspect of the place, and see if they echo each other. And you could think of it, those of you who might be clinicians, you were taught to do case histories. Try doing a place history. That's where my books came from. They're all place histories. The terapsychological ones. Look at the birth story of a settlement, and also the creation story of the original people who live in a place. And are there any similarities? Ask people who actually live in the place, does this really resonate or not? What I'm speculating about. What is the shadow of a place? My fieldwork advisor at Pacifica said, you know, you're back in San Diego after a long absence. This was when I was a doctoral student. Why don't you figure out what the shadow of San Diego is? And I went, yeah, that was an interesting exploration. Talk about a borderline city. And where's the eros in the city? What are the parts of the city that are exciting and that are expressions of passion somehow? I mentioned asking the place for dreams, and I gave an example of that. And the big question, who's here mythically? I can't tell you the number of times places have actually shown up as characters in my dreams. It gives a whole new layer to looking at what your dreams are. We're used to thinking of characters as parts of our psyche, but sometimes it's the place. What local activities work with the soul of the place and which don't? San Francisco, great place for anything to do with altering consciousness. No real surprise there. but in many different ways. I did a presentation for one of the local environmental groups there, and a suggestion I gave them was to get something passionate and ecstatic going in what you're doing with the public. Don't just give them depressing facts and figures about climate change. It'll just numb them out. How do you feel in this place? And how does your body actually feel in different parts of the city? Which of your complexes correspond to the cities? And we'll talk about that a little bit tomorrow. Which of your dream people could actually be aspects of the place addressing you? That's how all of this started for me. I'll touch on that in a second. What here activates your fantasies? What does this place represent on the way of your life's journey? And that, again, we're going to look at tomorrow in the workshop. And how do the archetypes and myths here speak to your personal myth? That's going to be the center of the workshop tomorrow. I actually had what started all this for me was having a dream in which the central character of the dream said to me point blank, in the dream I was trying to interpret her, and she said, like I was an idiot, I'm San Diego. And I woke up and went, wow. And is that possible? So here's an idea to test. The place and the world turns toward us. Jung said this about the unconscious. Turns toward us the face that we turn toward it. There was a team of storm trackers that saw this tornado detach from a cloud that it was going up into. And bend down, and it's in YouTube if you want to see this, bend down and look at them, so to speak. It was the first, tornadoes have been photographed from the inside before, but this was the first time the top of a tornado had been photographed from the inside like that, and they were completely blown away. They didn't interpret it as a meaningful gesture or anything like that, but it was just so unusual, it freaked them out. But I asked my students, if you have the fantasy that the tornado has a subjectivity, that it's a dream symbol of some kind, what would it be saying? And they usually come up with things like, look inside me. Don't just point cameras at me, but look into my essence. See through me. Look at me as an image that's interacting with you. So it can be interesting to see natural events this way, if you choose to. So to finish, here's the state, the only one named after a president. So whatever Seattle is, it's within that. In turn, it's on the West Coast, an edgy place. This is actually geologically the newest part of this continent. The coast used to be somewhere in Nevada, and over millions of years, island arcs got scraped up as the continent moved, plate tectonics, and got added. So this is all new rock compared to the rest of the continent. So no wonder new and edgy things happen here. So to take both continents, you're probably familiar with Jung's technique of looking up the etymology of words to see what the psychic history is of the word itself and what it can tell us on a symbolic level. I always do that with places. If you look up the word America, the first place you go to is the Italian navigator Amerigo Vespucci, but if you look up his name and you keep going, America actually has two meanings etymologically. It means master craftsman and great power. So this is where work gets done. And I mean both Americas, since we share a name. In many different languages, the name of our planet refers to ground. So all of this is, if you think of it as nested, so Seattle or your neighborhood within Seattle, which is within the state, which is on the West Coast, which is part of the continent, which is part of Gaia, if you want to use that word, the ancient Greek word, which is part of what Joseph Campbell referred to as the new myth of our time. The Earth actually rising as its own beautiful being into collective consciousness. This photograph was taken the day before Christmas, 1968. And what I like about this is the response of the astronauts is aesthetic. It's emotional. It's straight from the heart. Look how beautiful that is. The astronauts today actually have a term called the overview effect, and it refers to when you're a new astronaut and you go up, there will come a moment where you walk by the window and you see the Earth and you go, oh, wow. And you forget your work and the schedule and you are captivated by the beauty of it. And so this is Campbell's piece in the Power of Myth series. He says this is the mythic image for our time. When you see the Earth from the moon, you don't see any divisions there of nations or states. So the symbol of the new mythology. According, this is about a year before Campbell died. He also had a different statement that wasn't mentioned in that documentary. He said, I'll paraphrase him because I don't have it quite exactly, but he said, when you look at this image of Earth, all the dualisms that are based on heaven is above us, and Earth is below, and spirit is above us, and Earth is below, disappear. Because this image forces us to realize that the Earth is in the heavens. So widening a little further. We're almost done here. So we live in a galaxy named for Hera's flowing breast milk, the Milky Way. And there we are on one of the arms. We're in a giant spiral. By the way, spiral galaxies, they tend to last longer than other ones because of the spiral. The way the galaxy turns, spiral galaxies, it feeds gas to the stars that are in the arms, and they burn for longer. So if you ever wondered what your address is, I can tell you that part of it anyway. Your address So you're in the solar system, on planet Earth, obviously. The solar system is in something called the local fluff, which is in the local bubble, which is in the Gould Belt, and our lens is getting really wide now, which is in the Milky Way galaxy. We're actually on one of the arms, the Orion arm of the galaxy. This galaxy is one of dozens in the local group. By the way, our galaxy is about 100,000 light years across. One of a group. The local group is a little piece of the Virgo supercluster in the Pisces Cetus filament, possibly in what M theory people are now referring to as a daughter universe. Meaning, and there's a little picture of it up here, the idea is that two interdimensional membranes that we can't see, that the cosmos is full of them, but two of them came together close enough that there was a spark between them. We call it the Big Bang. So if things continue to shift this way in science, our creation story is changing. In many mythologies, the cosmic egg opening up is a very frequent mythological motif. It's in Chinese mythology, ancient Greek mythology, and others. But now it's shifting to the universal parents who give birth to an offspring that is all of creation. So a few last suggestions here. This is what I think of as coming home. It doesn't necessarily mean staying forever on a particular plot of land, but it can mean knowing yourself, knowing your place, where you should be. Seeing your ancestry as a lineage of metaphors that have to do with why you're here. You know that quote by Jung in MDR, right? In Memories, Dreams, Reflections, he says something like, I'm here to address the questions that my ancestors left unanswered. Feeling kinship with other living things, human and other, plant, animal, insect, and an ongoing conversation with the sacred as it actually manifests. And as we'll touch on tomorrow, learning how your story aligns with the circles of stories beyond you. There's no limit to where this work can go. So this is Jung from the Vision Seminar, and this is the last quotation. It is as if one were a microcosm which mirrors the macrocosm. And from that, one might conclude that there must be an avenue inside us that leads not to our particular psychological curiosities, I like how he puts that, but to the essence of things in general. There we go. So I mentioned earlier that there's a PDF version of the slideshow available online. So we're keeping a list over here. So when you leave, if you put your email address on it, they can contact me and I can send that to you to make sure you get that. I think what I'll do, I don't really like being behind this podium, so I'm going to get out from under it. But I think I'll take questions now and I'll just stand here. And if my voice isn't loud enough, tell me and I'll work something out with this mic. So, great. So,
can I ask one quick question?
Yeah.
Did anybody pick up off my desk this answer to Joe with a piece of paper? I had another one that's gone. Okay. Thank you.
So, questions? Yeah.
I always have a question for people here. But always, Seattle has been to me, it's not a boundary city.
Yeah.
Mountain air is part of the site for me.
Yeah.
The water, we have a 20-mile lake. We have the salt water. There are mountains on both sides. So it's that whole expanse that is the city.
Yeah.
So there's so much space, that space and abundant nature are part of the city. So
yeah. Yeah.
What that does with King or Crown or whatever, everybody has so much space, nobody's going to tell anybody what to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We're kind of like a lot of cats.
Yeah.
I just have to sit with that.
Yeah. There's, sometimes when I'm trying to, this comes up a lot in California where everything is kind of jammed next to each other, at least along the coast, you know. And I sometimes think, well, where does one place stop and another one start? And I try to go by, especially by how my body and my emotions feel when I'm, there's often a transition. Like when I drive or even get out of my car and walk a little bit, in that area between, let's say, Los Angeles County and Ventura County, I can not only feel a shift in myself, but I can see the vegetation change. So there's something about, let me put it a little differently. I think that before the myths are here, before any of the superstructure that's been built up, there's the land. And there must be, I think of them sometimes as proto-stories, there must be something about the land itself that's alive, that's the beginning of all of it. So students often ask me, where did the myth come from? Where did it start? And I always tell them, the land, it was here first. And then as people came and changed it, they filled out pieces of the mythology that's here. But I think ultimately it starts with the land and the place itself. That's Yeah, and that's why I always try to check with them. What do your people say was happening here? I usually assume that they're right and I'm wrong if they're different. But oftentimes, if I feel pretty tuned in, then we seem to get on to different myths for the same archetype that's happening here. So, trying to think of a place. I can think of one. Marin. If you look at a map of Marin, just the way a map usually sits, see if you can find the outline of Coyote. And then take the map and rotate it, and there should be a second Coyote. There's one on the west side and one on the east side. And its ear is up by Tomales Bay, and on the east side, its mouth is down by Richardson Bay. A lot of Coyote imagery and trickster stuff happening in Marin. And, of course, trickster is the god of not only healing but money. And if you know anything about Marin, you know why that would apply, you know. But the people who were there before went there for healing, and they went there to talk to Trickster. So something about the place. It's really, even after studying it all this time, it's just mysterious. And, you know, where it ultimately comes from, I don't know. And there's that question, well, which is first? Does the place fit a particular archetype, or is the archetype there first and the place grows up around it? Or I don't know. Like, beats me.
And you thought about your theories in terms of Rupert Sheldrake's what's it called, morphogenetic field?
Not being a thinking type, I sometimes have trouble getting my mind around his work, and a bunch of people have told me you should read more of him, and they're right. You know, I'm not really that familiar with it. A little bit, I know the basic ideas. And people have also brought up ley lines and geomancy and things like that. I think that would all be really interesting work to do. I'm going to blame Pacifica or James Hillman. You know how Hillman was always getting after people for being too literal about things? Literal energies, literal, you know, what have you. And I think that did something to my brain, because ever since my education, I'm much more interested in the symbolic connections and the metaphors and how they connect us. And so I think that's why I never got really interested in environmental psychology. There's different environmental psychologies. The one I do is eco-psychology, which I think goes deeper. But these, you know, there are people who spend their lives measuring, you know, like what I talked about earlier, how does this environment literally impact people who live in it. And I'm not for a moment criticizing their work. I think it's really important work that needs to be done. But for some reason, I've never been able to be interested in it. And I have a similar thing with, I think, literal explanations. So I'm not very good at them. maybe that's what it is. But I'd like to know more about them. And I always encourage students, if you're interested in this, go study it and tell me about it. I'd like to learn about it, you know. So, but that would be an area that really needs to be looked at. What does his work have to do with what we're talking about? And, you know, that would be a good study.
So you showed that slide about the divided Jerusalem, part of Jerusalem. Mm. And so so I visited Jerusalem, and my knowledge of Jerusalem is not deep. And so... But that sort of helped me in a way, because what I noticed when I was there is that there were, the, you know, with holograms, you can slice it and dice it, but it still comes out the same image.
Yeah.
So no matter what scale you look at that region, the same thing is happening. Dividing real estate in an attempt to solve a problem. And all the way down to the, I think it's called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where there are six different Christian denominations that divide up the territory of the church and fight to the point that they can't make repairs. The place is falling down because they can't agree on how to make the repairs. And they've got their territory within the church, and they fight physically over the territory. And the Ethiopians are on the roof, where like they're sort of, you know, like the low man on totem pole. And it's just phenomenal.
Yeah.
Because these are, that church is not big. And so it's all the way down to the smallest bits.
I'm getting this image of like the altar boys, you know, like, you know. I was picturing like the altar boys, you know. You're wrong, and I'm, you know.
Drawing blood. So it's like, it's as if the people who are there, no matter what groups, and at whatever scale, are sort of doing that same gig.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
When I've seen these odd parallels between what's happening in the ground, or even under the ground in this case, and something that continues generation after generation, I don't hold it as a single explanation. I'm always really suspicious, actually, of single explanations. But I think it's a big factor. I think it's part of whatever it is that's happening there.
Sort of a repeating dream.
Yeah.
And what the causal direction is
up. And the ironic thing is, it's supposed to be a place of peace. You know, the name has peace in the word, in Jerusalem. So, in pieces, yeah. Yeah, that's right. But that divided heart of that place, I wish somehow that, I don't know how this could ever happen, but it would be neat to see an exercise where different factions in a place role play the place itself. Like, I'm going to be this side of the earthquake fault, and you're going to be that side of the earthquake fault, and then we're going to have an argument, you know, but we're going to do it consciously, and then to see if that would shift anything.
Like trying to bring consciousness into the earth faults itself.
Yeah.
Huh.
Wow. I have a question that is kind of two-part. The first question, I noticed when you were speaking, you have the tendency to use "what if" as opposed to like a simple, like conclusive statement. And I think the first part of the question for me is, what is at stake? Because obviously, it seems to me like you're trying to ascribe agency to two counterimposing figures, like either man or like the earth itself. And so I'm wondering, like, what's at stake in that conflict, so that you feel like you have to suspend those two agents in contention, as opposed to like finding some sort of synthesis, or just like going ahead and saying, this is, you know, we do live in a dreamscape, for instance. And I guess in light of that, I wonder if you could use, towards answering that question about stakes and just going for it, I wonder what you would think, or if you could, I wonder if you could summarily present like a critique of the idea that it's called like planetarianism, which essentially takes for granted that human life and everything that we consider historical, by which I mean like religious ideology, social ideology, cultural ideology, is just an extension of a planetary maturation process. And like that seems to be like already there, but you're not quite with them, it seems, in your talk. So I'm wondering, like,
yeah, that's a good question. I can answer the second part first most easily, because I'm not really aware of their work. That's the only reason. I'd like to know more about it, actually. Since one of the things I learned doing dissertation work, you spend some years really trying to find out everything there is to know about whatever field you're working in, place, and you know all that. And there's so much to it. And so I did my best. But what happened to me, and what always happens to my students too, and they're always really bummed when this happens. So you graduate, you got the dissertation, you're the place guy or whatever your thing is, you know. And then you find out a month later that somebody else has written something about it that would have been really helpful for your work. And you're like, you know. but I haven't heard that work. So I have sometimes speculated that in a way we're in certain places for their evolution. They last a lot longer than we do. So it say that again, sorry.
When you're talking about there, are you talking about planets?
Oh, no, sorry, geographical locales. Right, but your question, though, is other planets, other worlds, right?
Well, no, just specifically
oh, okay.
The Earth.
Yeah. So kind of speaking to that, I think, some of my environmentalist friends and colleagues don't like my interest in the space program. And they, for various political reasons, you know, they oppose it. Well, we're getting away from the Earth. We need to get closer to the Earth and things like that, you know. So I'll sometimes play with them a little bit by suggesting that satellites and orbital cameras are Gaia's hand mirrors, and that part of why we're here is to help her appreciate her own beauty. And the reason I tend to put all this tentatively, well, a couple of reasons. One is that I don't operate in the empirical proof worldview. The other thing is I'm more interested in inviting people to make their own explorations of how all this works. And I can't come from a place of authority to do that. I actually have a couple of times made pretty hard claims about things. And it tends to engender a lot of opposition and I don't mind, I mean, if I minded controversy, I wouldn't be talking about topics like these, you know, but it seems to engender the wrong kind, where nothing gets resolved and positions get polarized. But when I present it instead in the form of speculation or playing with ideas, then I see this in my students a lot too, and actually in my colleagues. They go, well, he's nuts, but that's kind of a cool idea. And then they start doing it a little bit. So there have been a couple of things, though, where I do take a much stronger stand. And one of them is the ongoing genocide of Native people in my homeland in California. And that's what's happening to them is wrong, and it's evil. And so I have publicly said that. I've been saying it since first grade on TV, actually. So in areas like that, I will do that. But when it's more in the form of an invitation, then I tend to be a little bit more tentative. So does that?
Yeah.
Okay.
We can maybe talk for a second.
Great. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, maybe your last comments give me a venue into what's happening in Seattle in terms of history. Is that the people, poorer people, and even people like me, are becoming part of the flotsam and jetsam of history. And
yes.
Like San Francisco and New York, the poor are being pushed out.
Yeah.
And the less money you have, the less you're going to be here. And so while I admit that, you know, there's always a natural frame in which we live and a ground on which we perch and operate, you can put the flotsam and jetsam somewhere in this collision of authorities, but it's not going to help them a whole lot to use this. And I have to work with some of these people and with myself. So the question is, of what use is it to people? And then my second question has to do with climate is altering our sense of place.
Yeah.
And what do you have to say about that?
Yeah,
you know, when water pours down the valley and kills somebody in a basement.
Yeah, where I'm living right now, we're in a record-breaking drought. And specifically in the Bay Area, we just had the first January with no rain whatsoever since records have been kept. That's never happened. And NASA is telling us that over the next, they say that the drought will expand into the entire west of the United States, and it will almost never end. So that is terrible news for all of us. Yeah, yeah. And then there's things like, on a practical level, in California there's the Central Valley where something like one-third of the nation's table food comes from. And the Central Valley is dying. And it would be dying even without climate change, because when you irrigate and irrigate and irrigate, you know, Sumer should have taught us this, right? They're the first empire that fell partly because of salt coming to the surface. When you irrigate, that's why crops have to lie fallow after, you know. But usually you can wash the salt out, except in the valley. It's sealed in hardpan. It's mineralized clay. The whole valley of California is like a huge alchemical container, which I think is one of the reasons there's so much transformation in it. And there's nowhere to wash the salt. So you can drive up 5 or 99 and see acre after acre of parched, salted land. So what are we going to do without that food? I mean, and you know who's going to be hit the hardest? The people who can't afford to be, you know. So anyway. Yeah, climate change, I think, to answer the question on the level of a symbol, it's almost as though we are turning the earth into an alchemical chamber itself, and we're turning up the heat. So things are going, things, yeah, yeah, cooked, cooked, we're alchemically cooked. Alchemists talked a lot about 4 degrees of fire and how you have to be careful which ones you use. And, you know, if you think about what's overheating our planet, largely being caused by something called the internal combustion engine, isn't that a weird image? I mean, our civilization depends on constant explosions, internal explosions. I think that's amazing. So we're not dealing with our internal explosions, and as a result, we're overheating the entire world. So there needs to be some sort of work around that. To answer your other question about the practicality piece, so I think when you understand the nature of a place, it can help you understand the nature of why you're there and the work that you have to do with the people who live there. For instance, I used to wonder why there was so much incredible alcoholism and drug addiction in San Francisco, and I don't anymore. It's of the quality of the place. And so if I were still, I don't do psychotherapy anymore because I'm a full-time educator and department chair, but if I were still working with people, I would deal with addiction differently in San Francisco than I would, say, in Oakland, because of the nature of the place. In San Francisco, my assumption would be something like, maybe a lot of these people are unconscious followers of Dionysus, and they don't even know it. So what's underneath the symptoms? Is there a spiritual urge there that's not being met somehow, in a very specific way? And that wouldn't be a question I would ask in Oakland, or in Marin or other places. So I think it can help us work with people on that level. But the other thing is, I've been very impressed with the power of story in terms of changing people's lives. And I have an example of that. There was a guy who, he needs to be taught actually in depth psychology circles much more. Has anyone ever heard of a guy named Elias, let's see if I can pronounce his name right. I'm part Finnish, so maybe that'll help. Elias Lernroth. He was Finnish. He was a doctor who collected stories. So in the late 1800s, he was bothered by the fact that the Finns, sandwiched between the powerful Swedes and the powerful Russians, had basically no sense of themselves as a people. And so he didn't consciously connect these dots until later, but he said, isn't it kind of stupid that we don't have our own mythology? And so he started gathering stories. He went and talked to, you know, village storytellers and just anybody who had good stories about Finnish folklore, He put them all together into one epic book called the Kalevala. And it was a huge success, to the point where people in the streets of Finland were coming up to him and they were saying, "You have given us back our heritage." So eventually, the Finns, and they themselves would say, it's this book, right? They declared independence from everybody in 1917. The Russians tried to kick them in the butt for that. They kicked the Russians in the butt in return. So what that tells me is that even when it's just a bunch of myths and fairy tales that don't seem to be of any practical utility whatsoever for our current situation, the empowerment that they can give people has enormous practical consequences. So if we can tell stories of place, I think that they can resonate and make change on many different levels that we cannot immediately see. I've had a lot of people tell me, I look at California differently because of what you've written about it. And it doesn't even matter if they agree with me or not. They're doing their own investigation of what's happening. So, one other comment I'll make about that. I think that if we had better stories about not necessarily my stories, just better stories about our relationship to place and community and land, I don't think we'd be in all this trouble. I think our relationship on this planet would look very different from how it does now. So I'm a big fan of anything that encourages good storytelling about any aspect of this. I should mention, too, that guy, Lernroth, who collected all those stories, had a huge influence on another person who came along. His name was J.R.R. Tolkien. And he said, "Why doesn't England have a good mythology?" Well, we have King Arthur, but he's British, and he started out in Wales, you know. So he set out to write one and ended up writing a fantasy epic. But there are people who are environmental activists. There were people in Russia not that long ago who quote Tolkien. Not another activist necessarily, not a political pamphlet or environmental fact sheets or whatever. They're saying, we're turning the planet into Mordor and we have to stop. So that is very practical, I think, the story piece.
I have one. First of all, I want to thank you. I think this was one of the most interesting lectures I've attended at the Seattle Young Society. I'm so glad they brought you here. And I want to ask about what you opened with, which was one of the most interesting definitions of archetypes I've heard this. Mm-hmm. And, what I sense from your whole talk is this way of feeling archetype being larger than any of these levels, in the human level or the land level. So often when I hear the word mental, I think human, but that's not right, right? I mean, you're suggesting that the archetype is functioning in this largest sense, right?
Yeah.
And so there's this connection. It's another way of feeling as above, so below.
Yeah.
I'm getting it. Yeah. So I feel this. I feel very enlivened by your talk, and I've been thinking a little bit about Martin Buber's, I Bow. That you're giving me the most practical kind of opening to an I Bow. I want to thank you. So, what a great way to end, right? Let's end. Thank you.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.